session of January 26, 1977. At the end of the last session, some of you were kind enough to make a few remarks, to make a few suggestions, and to provide additional references relating to what was said. It's something I value. The productive practice, it's that it's a collaborative rather than progressive enterprise. My role is to give you categories, boxes, and these boxes will be filled by you. Every time this can happen, at the beginning of each session, I will incorporate those remarks. It's like exchanging letters with the audience. So here are the suggestions. I asked why the word idiorhythmy was written with two R's. Idiorrh, it's due to the aspirated rho in Greek. I said I didn't know any idiorhythmic novel. Someone mentioned Goethe's Elective Affinities and a novel by Simone Jacquemart. I don't know. About the word acedi. The term I used discussed last time. Two remarks were given to me. I talked about the dead point, point mort. And I quoted Hans Castorp, the hero of the Magic Mountain. There is something similar with the narrator of In Search of Lost Time. At the beginning, there is a sense of acedi. And at the end, he comes back to Paris after having stayed in various sanatoria. See, it's the moment when he understands he's not made for worldliness, but has to de-invest worldliness and invest writing. This is the moment when he arrives at the Guermantes party, just before time regained. There is a sudden change at the end, a miraculous turning around. He goes to the party of the Guermantes and will decide to become a writer. He finds the meaning of writing then. Somebody mentioned that kedeia in Greek meant burial, and then Acadia could mean something connected with Kedeya. It's mourning without an object. I said that it was a matter of mourning the feeling more than mourning the object. This very painful state is the climax of desolation. Why? Because it's similar to something like death. Death with no sepulture. Death with no burial. This is it. Now I can return to my terms. We'll meet again another Greek term, anachoresis. It's made of ana, a prefix meaning a distance in an upward direction. Korein means to go back up to a distant place. Anachoresis is an act or a state or a concept of a separation from the world achieved by going back up to some isolated, private, secret, distant place. It's a retreat. It's above all being away from the city. Of course, the word has taken a very specialized meaning in connection with the beginning of Christianity. The anachorete lives in a little cell, a cabin, kellion, that may or may not attach to a monastery. Anachoresis is not a matter of absolute solitude, but rather a way of reducing one's contact with the world. Retreating from the world, there was a sharp rise in anachoresis at the end of the 3rd century, the beginning of the 4th century. We had Anthony, the Pharaoh's tombs, people would go to oases, to the Egyptian mountains. It was a religious solution, but a way of rejecting any constraint from the state, taxes, a rejection of military service, the encroachments of the state were rejected. It's a total independence. One protects this independence, minimizing contact with society. Everyone would tend to organize themselves as they saw it fit. It's a regime of private prayer, with manual labor in Egypt. They would make baskets, they would weave, they would braid. Here we have to be aware that anachoresis does not coincide with eremitism. There is the possibility of two or three people living together. There are groups of anachorets. They would try to temperate each other's eccentricities. Otherwise, there was total eccentricity. Anachorites would meet at least often on Saturdays for a communal prayer in the 4th century, that is. This communal prayer was called a synax, with a common liturgy. From this we can infer a metaphorical value. Anachoresis is always tempted by a foundational act, breaking away, the abrupt jolt of departure. Anachoresis is first an act. There is a threshold to be crossed. If we go back to Robinson Crusoe, he is wrenched from the world by the shipwreck. It's anachoresis, symbolically. In a single stroke, Crusoe is deprived of all his companions. Only three of the hats, one cap, and two shoes that were not fellows, floating on the surface of the sea. After 13 days, the ship sinks. That was his last remaining link to the world, and that link is broken. The world will resurface later on in the form of cannibals. We have a purely secular anachoresis. At the end of his life, Spinoza retires to Vorburg near The Hague. That was in Vorburg. First, he takes lodgings in a boarding house. He then decides he's spending too much money. He rents a room in someone's home so he can eat what he likes. True anachoresis, we can say, because he would sometime go downstairs to converse with his hosts. He lived a very retired life according to his fancy. It is also idiorhythmy. The notion of anachoresis needs to be clarified for three reasons. First, historically, it is the template for idiorhythmy. It represents a collective individualistic structure. Second, anachoresis is any fantasy involving a moderate form of retreat. the calming, pacifying image of Spinoza. Anachoresis is experienced by the individual as a solution to the crisis of power. I free, I reject power, I reject the world, systems. I want to create a life structure that isn't a life system. Anachorein means to reject power, to object to power, even if only to other people as power. Today, in the contemporary world, we have a secular version of anachoresis. Given today's gregariousness, alienation, forms that are pregnant with power, we have the opposite: dreams, fantasies, acts of distancing. It's a little like the dream of selling everything, buying a sheep farm in the Ardèche region. Or less specifically, going off to live in a country, return to the countryside. This is what you see in the advertising campaign by Gervais Cheese. You return to the countryside by eating cheese. You isolate yourself, you retain just one or two points of anchorage. This is a balanced form of anachoresis. There are indeed a few crazy forms. I now reach my third term in the alphabetical order. It's the theme of animals. Chance created this alphabetical contiguity. There is, in fact, a thematic connection between anachoresis and animality. Let's consider two contrasting movements from the beast to man, and we have Robinson, and then the second from man to beast. We find this in excessive forms of religious anachoresis. First movement, from animal to man, Robinson. He starts out from a state of nature or thereabouts. Before he gets back some objects from the ship, all he has is a knife, a pipe, and a bit of tobacco. From there, he proceeds to work his way through each phase of civilization. He sleeps in a tree, then he has a raft, then he has some objects, then he makes a hut, and then at the end of the process, he becomes the ruler of what he thinks is an inhabited island. The ascendancy from animal to man runs in parallel to another symmetrical movement, the domestication of animals. Mm-hmm. It can only be there by domesticating animals. There are several moments well described in that superb novel. First, man and animal are equals. There's a wild cat. She sat very composed and unconcerned and looked full in my face as if she had a mind to be acquainted with me. This equality is perfect. Robinson sees that cat as he would an enemy. In the face of the cat's indifference, Crusoe tosses her a bit of biscuit. Second moment, taming the goat. First he maims the goat, and then he tames it. He then has the idea of a systematic domestication of animals. This will supply him with food once he's no longer able to hunt, that is, when his gunpowder and shot are spent. There is the second phase then of domestication, anthropophilia. The animal is made to live commensally with man. The animal becomes a substitute for man. It's first a substitute for language. There is the parrot. Robinson captures one so they can speak. After many years of training, at the end, the parrot calls Robinson Crusoe familiarly by name. He could have taught any kind of word, but he wants the name. The animal can address him. There is an interpolation. One can fetishize an object as a person. One can say you to a fetish. Let's think of the parrot in Flaubert's A Simple Heart. But it's not possible to solicit a familiar you from an object. Whence the irrepressible nature of Robinson Crusoe's parrot is like a human being. There's the substitute for affect, the half-starved young goat. Robinson feeds the goat, and the creature becomes, quote, so loving, so gentle, so fond, that it became from that time on one of my domestics and would never leave me afterwards. This is a power over animals, but it's humble, non-aggressive. There's a harmonization. Robinson creates affect with power. The young goat is tamed and he becomes a sort of fellow human. This is a strong humanizing power to create affect. As a digression, I'd like to return to this anthropological phenomenon, the domestication issue. I will use Diderot's famous word. You know how one likes to talk about what one has just learned. It's in the letter on the deaf and dumb. This is also to be seen in the perspective of selection, the natural selection. How natural selection operates on wild species. There is a speeded up selection that focuses upon a few characteristic features that are found to be valuable. A species of wild animal must be predisposed to anthropophilia, that is, to be able to live commensally with man. It leads to the capacity for impregnation, for imprinting. There is a unique experience during which a young wild animal can form an attachment to man. A wolf cub captured at birth and raised by man will behave like a dog. This is impregnation, cohabitation. Upon the very first hours of life, and it depends upon what or who the animal sees first. A puppy that spends the first 3 months of its life in the wild becomes irreversibly wild. We have the same imprinting in the relation between Robinson Crusoe and the kid. The imprinting implies an affective capacity needed as a conduit of the imprinting process. There are two phases in man's history. In the Paleolithic period, hunters would take live animals to their homes. They just kept them as a supply of fresh meat. Taming implies that man and animals are able to live together, cohabiting. Hunters tame animals to keep them. But if they are able to reproduce in captivity, you then have the maximum degree of imprinting. The second phase is selection by man. It's sorting according to type. Man breeds selected species isolated for specific purposes. different breeds for meat, milk, labor, and so on. Anthropologists and paleontologists have been able to date these processes. The first domesticated animal was the dog, originally a cross between the European wolf and the Asiatic wolf. This took place around 10,000 years BC. After that first taming, they were used for hunting and gathering. Then the mutton, 6,700 years, the pork, 6,500, beef, 6,000, poultry, 2,000. Finally, the last to be tamed was the rabbit. 9th century AD. This came from North Africa via Spain. In the Middle Ages, people didn't know exactly what a rabbit was, and it could replace fish in the time of Lent. It wasn't seen as meat. What is interesting here is that there is now an ecological risk. It's caused by over-selection. If you select too much some species, other species die out. In France, for instance, in 1939, you had 21 breeds of cattle. In 1972, only 7. The selection is good for production, but bad for the general ecological system. Donkeys are now in the process of becoming totally extinct. If there was another ecological disaster, like famine, there wouldn't be any genetically feasible alternative. The world of domestic animals is very, very fragile. This is the first progression from animals to man. Now we are going to follow the anachorites. In religious anachoresis, man is tempted by animality. There are three main forms for this. The first is a neutral form. In that form, animals represent nature. animals are opposed to society. Anachoresis is a literal return to nature, hence to animality. There are many examples in the Christian tradition, but also in Brahmanic India. The Ulobiyoi are the forest-dwelling hermits. They live in the forests in the way animals do. Christian anachorites, especially in Syria, in the 4th century, where you had the most radical idiosyncratic forms of anachoresis. They were linked with nature and animals. There are those who were called the grazers. They would eat grass, roots, leaves, no cooked food. A total return to animal food. The dendrites, they would nest in trees, they would be with the birds. Robinson has a similar problem at first. We see this in the sequel to Robinson Crusoe, the Swiss Family Robinson. They also build a house in a tree. From living like an animal, we move on to being an animal. The anachorite is an animal. This is the condition for being in nature. There are many anecdotes. For instance, an anachorete, Asaximus, who walks on all fours. In the end, he was put into iron shackles. One day, a shepherd mistook him for a wolf and just missed killing him with his slingshot. Another, Talilus, gets a squirrel's cage built for himself with a wheel inside, and he is discovered curled up in his cage, his knees up against his chin, reading the Gospels. One can say the anachorite becomes an animal. In this case, he turned himself into a squirrel. Then there is a second conception: animals embody evil. There's an immense theme, immense wealth of images. Demons are figured in animal form. This is the theme of Anthony. We see demons entering St. Anthony's cave, snakes, lions, bears, leopards, bulls, wolves, aspics, scorpions, all the wild beasts. This profusion is seen in many paintings. Animality is an infra-nature. It calls up aggression, fear, greed, flesh. It's the figure of man without law. We see this, say,
in the caves at Lascaux, and we see this in Valtuzaiti's work. The third one is animals as redeemed or inverted nature. The animal leads to a miracle. They invert their basic animal nature. It's often connected with anachoresis. Lions will bury Paul of Thebes. A lion will bring Simeon a meal of dates. Elijah is fed by a raven. This is the theme, a very important theme, of the inverted animal, the theme of impossibilia, adunata, in the Middle Ages. Impossibilities. It's a topos of ancient literature to figure excess, the world turned upside down. The association of incompatible things as a metaphor for a world turns upside down. There is the form of the good animal. In religious anachoresis, it exists. Hermits choose at times to live with a domestic animal. It's a way of attenuating solitude without the risk of sin. But not necessarily so. For Saint Gregory, a hermit is deemed to be too fond of his kitten. He receives a supernatural warning to grow less attached to it. This is the aporia, typical of love. How is it possible to love someone just a little bit? Saint Gregory had fallen into that quandary. The links between animals and humans offer very rich themes, but it's a circular thematics. The animal can occupy any one of the places in a paradigm, from good to bad to neither to both. Thank you. Animals can be bad, inverted animals whose untamed animality can be conquered. This is what I had to say about animals. Now, the alphabet sends us to Athos, Mount Athos. I shall group key aspects of religious idiorhythmy under Athos. It has a particular historical connection to the place. A few words about the history. There's an exemplary episode, a generative model of the idiorhythmic structure. It's again around the character of Anthony. As the story has, he was first a total hermit, but then he starts offering instruction to ascetics who gathered around him. The region was Pispia, a desert to the south of Alexandria. This group of Anachorites would create an idiorhythmic organization. They would spend 5 days of the week alone. In some cases, there were three or four to a hut. As a rule, no one is really acquainted with anyone else. They didn't live very far from each other. They had wholly solitary activities. On Saturday afternoons, on Sundays, they would come together in a central spot, church, for prayer, to sell their baskets and mats, stock up on palm fibers, salt, and bread. There was no leader, no chief, just an elder. At times the model, you might say, a guru, Anthony. Athos, initially, was a scattering of hermitages. It's the place for natural, unregulated idiorhythmy. By definition, this is something that has never been discussed. it has fallen outside historiography. There is a contradiction between idiorhythmy and historiography. Very, very soon, this form of isolation, eremitism, becomes socially unacceptable. Power has to take over. In 963, the 10th century, Saint Athanasius founds the Great Laura, the first cenobitic monastery. That is the foundation of Athos. On Athos, there is a spread of cenobia in the north and idiorhythmic semi-anachoritism in the south. In the 15th century, that part of Greece falls into Turkish rule with the fall of Thessaloniki. The strict regime then becomes lenient. Then idiorhythmy spreads until the 17th century, when idiorhythmy is adopted by all major monasteries. Today, Athos is in decline. There were 7,000 monks in 1912, and now 1,500. There are 9 idiorhythmic monasteries, 8 in Greece, 1 in Serbia. Legally, Athos is the Athenite Federation of Monasteries governed by a council under Greek protection. That was decided in 1912. As a conclusion of this historical part, I'll stress the ambivalence of idiorhythmy. At times, it is strict, pure, impoverished asceticism. At times, it is just comfortable, free, relaxed asceticism. The point is not that it's a matter of tension, but of marginality. Athos was also a place for mystical experiences. Those who lived there were the hansikastes, the silent ones. The practice was a rhythmic prayer based on the cadences of respiration and the heart. This corresponds to Byzantine pneumatology. In the north coast, we have large monasteries. You see the Mediterranean forest, no she-goats. In the south of Athos, a rocky desert. Hermitages and Skites. skites are those who live in a skellion. And you have then the Laureates, a generic term for monasteries on Mount Athos. It's often translated by lore in French. The Laura can be a transitional kinobium, where monks prepare themselves for solitude, 3 or 4 years. Or it can be a community of 12 people. Here again, the phenomenon is defined by its scale, more than in strict hermetism, less than in a monastery. This is an hermetism tempered with cenobitism. The only Catholic order is the order Eremiticus. Today, the structure of idiorhythmi corresponds to small apartments with a private chapel. Those who live there keep their goods, their possessions. You have a sort of bourgeois dwelling for erstwhile prelates. You know the lability of forms. At times, anachorites are very, very close to each other. At times, they are far away. There is a similar lability in the degree of concentration, the number of participants, and the economic standing from poverty to wealth. We'll meet again next Wednesday. We'll have a little more room next week. See you next Wednesday. Yes.